Good morning and welcome to the Atypical Metal Dad podcast. It is Monday, October 12th, 6:45, not terribly early. Wasn't really sure that I was going to do anything this morning, but on a Monday morning, really just getting motivated for work has become more and more of a challenge because I just have absolutely zero interest in what I'm doing, zero enjoyment out of it. Really never been in a position like this in my life. So boiling point is coming close. So, I'd say probably within the next couple of months, moves will be made and chances will be taken. But anyhow, this morning I just kind of got on the random thought of value of records. So I very rarely ever look at my very rarely ever look at my collection in terms of value. But you know, having it in Discogs, it's there no matter what. So even if you're not paying attention to it, you log in, it shows you your min, medium, and max value. So every once in a great while, and it's actually been probably 6-7 months since I've even looked, every once in a while I like to sort by the highest median level titles and see, you know, what are considered technically my most quote unquote valuable records. And you know, I know the old saying, it's only worth what someone's going to pay for, and I'm not selling any of these, so you know, they could be worth $1 billion or they could be worth a penny, it doesn't matter. But I always just kind of curious to see which ones are popular, and honestly the top couple haven't changed. They may have switched positions, but the top five have been rounded out by at least three of them consistently. So I'm going to start with the top one, and I'll even give a little bit of a story about where I grabbed each of these, because surprisingly, my short memory, a little bit lacking, long-term memory still pretty solid. So the highest one that's currently showing, and I can't imagine that this will ever sell for this, but I guess it has, Tesseract, Altered State. This was the 2013 pressing, I guess, and it's shown at about $156. So I remember, I mean, this is actually one of my, I did one of my cleaning videos on this for Instagram, if I'm not mistaken. This is one of my favorite records of all time. I probably have a list of top 10 that I should go through at some point, because I generally have discussed each of those records, or at least six out of the what I'd consider my top 10 at some point during any of these podcast episodes. But anyway, this was certainly one of them. I mean, the vocalist on that just pulls together a tremendous vocal performance on top of just some really good progressive metal. You know, kind of fires on all cylinders, that one. Tough to beat for them. Tough to beat by anybody else in the genre, in my opinion. But anyway, I was just, going up for work. In my previous role, I drove around, New England for the greater part of 20 years, and kind of went into New York State quite a bit and down a little bit lower than New England, Pennsylvania, et cetera. But kind of, we'll call it the greater Northeast. And, you know, one of my favorite places to go was Burlington, Vermont. Always great beer, couple of great record stores. Just a fun town to be in. And you know, this, I was up there for a business trip. I distinctly remember going up there, like a long weekend with my then girlfriend, now wife, prior to this. And she took me to a Himalayan restaurant for my 40th birthday, which is what we went up there for, and it was fantastic. So I was like, hey, you know what? I'm traveling by myself. Usually, I had never really would like to go out to dinner by myself, even though I spend a lot of time on the road. I was more of a take it to go guy. I'm an eat back in the hotel room, you know, do listen to some music on my laptop, do some work or whatever. But this time I was like, you know, screw it. I'm going to go downtown to look at records. I may as well go to this place anyway. So I kind of had two reasons to trek downtown. And sure as shit, found this bad boy on a platter, in the bin. Just, you know, as with all of the others. Now it wasn't as rare at the time, obviously, but it wasn't a record that was easy to find in stores. It was, you know, even price wise on Discogs, I think it was getting up to about $40, and I think it was just regular $29 or whatever it was there. Honestly, I can't remember the name of the store in Burlington, Vermont, but there's only two of them, and this one you got to walk downstairs to get to. So, shout out to unnamed store in Burlington, Vermont. But I still get that record on and give it a spin every month or so. It's just a great pressing. And again, really one of the great vocal performances. You know, the lead singer, I believe his name is Ash. He ended up only doing one album with Tesseract. And then, you know, went kind of back and did some more work with his other band, Voices from the Fuselage. in their latest release, which I think was just put out on CD probably about a year or so ago, was Odyssey or something like that. It's got a longer name. Again, the vocal performance is off the charts. Dude can sing. Dude can write a good song. The second one in terms of value is Hope's Fall, The Satellite Years. I've got the clearish purple one, I believe. And that one's showing at about $104. That one was, I mean, there's really no fancy story about that one. I just pre-ordered it, you know, mainly for the fact that I used to spin that album, that CD, just constantly. I mean, that was one of the, you know, right about the time where that type of metalcore was kind of coming out, where it was, you know, it was kind of branching off. You had all of the really heavy riffing and European sound and stuff. And then you kind of got the stuff that sounded a little bit more like some traditional hardcore, and then had a lot more cleaner vocals kind of in them. And this was one of the CDs. And this, along with Tear from the Red by Poison the Well, were two of my favorites at the time. So, you know, getting this was really just a matter of nostalgia. And, you know, this is one of those records where I have for nostalgia. I might whip it out once a year. I think, honestly, I've had it for 2 years and I've probably spun it two times, maybe three at the most. So I'm really kind of surprised that, you know, as a repress, it went back up, as high as it did. But, I guess there's a hell of a lot more demand, you know, for that record than I anticipated. And I don't know what the repress levels were. But it seems like another repress is in order. That's always one of the things that I've toyed with too, because I'm not really much a collector for value, but obviously I'm not just going to poop, you know, poop it away, or piss it away is probably a better term. But, you know, do you ever just think about selling some of your high value records when there's a repress, you know, if there's going to be a repress out, and then just grabbing the repress? If really all you care about is the music, you kind of cover all your bases there. If there are people that don't just care about the music, that care about the music, but also care about the collection part of it. So they want particular releases, you know, for their value or to complete their collection. So you kind of, you know, you sell it off and you tick somebody's box on that end. Obviously, you make some money that you can reinvest into, you know, if I were to sell this, I could probably pick up three or four records that I would listen to on a regular basis. So every once in a while, I toy with that idea. And every once in a great while, I will sell a record like that. I've been kind of putting some of my, you know, what I would call my, I don't want to call them duds, but some of the records that don't have a tremendous amount of value, and I also don't have a tremendous amount of value for them in terms of listening. So I've kind of been pumping some of that lower end stuff onto Discogs, and it's good because, you know, they don't mean much to me. They weren't terribly expensive, and they're not terribly expensive, so you're kind of sending off some music for a fairly cheap price. And, you know, I think I've sold only one or two of them, but hey, that's one or two people that are actually looking for that record that now have it. So that's a win-win for me, because, you know, I'm starting to get to the point where I'm well over 600, and I got to look at it and wonder how many of these I'm actually really legitimately going to spin. I just combined the two of those, excuse me. How many of those I'm going to spin, and how many are just taking up space? And, you know, space will run out eventually. And I don't really know what my goals are with this. Is it just to keep amassing a massive collection? Is it to kind of manage it and, you know, listen to the records that you're really into? And then as your tastes change over the couple of years, you kind of cycle stuff out. I don't know. I don't really have a plan for it. I just, every once in a while, I look at my shelves, and if they're too full, I start going through and pulling some stuff out and trying to figure what I'm going to do with it. Right now, I've got a stack of about 50 records, if not more, sitting out there that, eventually I'd like to set up at a record show, and combine that with obviously a bunch of other stuff that I'm pulling in, specifically for that purpose, newer records, and roll deep with stuff like that. But until that ever happens, I've got to figure out what I'm going to do with them. Maybe try to move them up on Discogs a little bit more. But anyway, the third one is Veil of Maya, Id. And that one is cracking. That's a purple release from 2012, cracking at about $100 median. And that one, again, no fancy story. I just remember seeing that when I was shopping online at Best Buy. And I think they may have even had like some coupon on vinyl. So I grabbed a bunch of them. And this one actually has a slight warp. So I would suspect that $100 isn't quite accurate. Fortunately, it's very slight and doesn't bother me. Not enough where I'd be concerned about ruining the stylus. But this one I just grabbed, I mean, I won't even pretend that I'm the hugest Veil of Maya fan. This is the only one that I have by them. But this was kind of before they, you know, I know they've gone through several singers. I don't recall any clean vocals on this one, and you know, their last couple of releases have gone in a more you know, the Genty style that has, you know, I'll call it periphery style. That's, you know, it's one of those things. I hate to say it, because I don't say it as an insult. The lead vocalist sounds very similar to the dude from Periphery, and if I could sound like the dude from Periphery, I don't know why I wouldn't. I mean, the dude can sing. I thought about that. There was a band called Airshot, and the dude's vocals sound eerily familiar to Maynard from Tool. And I was like, oh, it's just a Tool ripoff. And I'm like, yeah, but if you could sing like Maynard from Tool, why would you not? What are you supposed to do? You know, that's an impeccable voice. The only unfortunate thing is that there's someone much more popular that came before you. But what do? Do you just try to use some terrible voice that's going to get you nowhere? How do you make it your own when it's so similar? But anyway, that's kind of where Veil of Maya went off, in my opinion. But again, I mean, I'm sure their fans came with them. I was just never huge before or after that. I didn't grow with them as part of their evolution, but this record slaps hard. This record actually has the distinct pleasure of being one specific record that my wife actually said she hated. she's not into the heavy music. She likes a little bit of punk stuff, but generally doesn't spend nearly as much time or interest with music as I do. And when we were in our last place together, which was painfully small after we had twins, my turntable and stereo was kind of in our main living area, which wasn't a problem when it was just the two of us. And then my older son, he had the downstairs. So, you know, she had a couple of areas that she could go into, and I could just stay out and listen to music. And worst case scenario, if she wanted to be out there, I'd just slap headphones on. But anyway, you know, I would just put one record on, you know, after the kids went to bed light, and, you know, she would take a shower. So I'd have about 20 minutes of listening time to myself. That was a long year, by the way. Between the time we had our twins and moved into our current house, there was almost no record listening time, no music listening time. Just because of the setup of it. It was all out there, and the whole family was out there. And then when the kids went to bed, there was really nowhere for me to really turn anything up. I was fortunate. I did have a little bit of a desktop setup. So I'd be, that's really the only way I could concentrate at work again, because of the open setup. I was downstairs, but it was wide open. So I got a little desktop setup and got some really good headphones, and at least got to stay connected to music digital. But I went through about a year where there was very, very little time. I'd get some time on a Sunday, if I wasn't running around, because my wife would take the little ones to go see her parents for most of the day. So if I was around the house cleaning, that was it. But anyway, a little circular story there. But to wind back, so one of those nights where I was listening to this and had it on, the volume that was just enough where I wouldn't wake up the kids, but, you know, just not soft enough where I'd be like, what the hell, man, I can't even hear this if I'm walking around the house. And she came out of the shower and heard the vocals, which were pretty vicious in this one. And she said, who is this? And I told her, she goes, oh, I hate this one. And I started laughing because I just remember, I was like, you've never criticized any of it. She goes, oh, those vocals. So that will always stand out in my mind. So she hates one of the most valuable records in my collection. My wife hates. Going down the line and rounding this out, number four, getting near the end. You guys really, really excited about this? This is some real riveting shit. But anyway, this one here, Isis Panopticon. It's the limited clear and blue, I guess. I'm just kind of reading this off of Discogs. And I grabbed this one just sitting on a shelf at Armageddon Shop. This was $29.99. I remember this, and it looks like it was added to my collection over 2 years ago, which doesn't necessarily mean it was a terribly long purchase, a purchase made terribly long ago. I'm trying to think this through, because I didn't immediately go into and log everything in Discogs. I think I waited until I got up about 250 and said, I better start tracking this, because I'm having trouble remembering if I have particular records or not. But being over 2 years means this was actually older than that, because I went through that exercise. So, you know, this probably has been in my collection for, I'd say, a minimum of 2 years, but trying to guess would be about three. This was actually, again, Isis is not a band that I celebrate their entire catalog, but usually, and I know this is blasphemy of a lot of, like, you know, fans that have been fans of Isis from the beginning, but this is actually kind of where I start and mostly stop with them. I just particularly loved this album. It was really the first post-metal album that I got into at all, so that kind of set me on exploring other bands like Cult of Luna and kind of getting, you know, adding filling that in, and then, you know, eventually you get led to bands like Amun-Ra that become real staples in your collection. So, you know, sometimes even the band that that introduces you to a genre may not end up being your favorite one. And I also have Wavering Radiant, also picked up on the shelf at Armageddon Shop while we're on that topic. But this was the style of theirs that I liked the most. I know they got their roots from the hardcore stuff, and I've gone back and listened to, was it Mosquito EP, and then what was the other one? Mosquito Control, and then the Red Sea, I believe they were called. And those were definitely, you know, that's the type of stuff that reminds me of like that first Cult of Luna one, where there was just an early Amun-Ra. So it's definitely far more raw, and you see exactly how they went down the path that they did. But again, mine starts with Panopticon. I'm really glad that I have that record in my collection, because the guitar work on that just sounds friggin' amazing. And we're gonna round it out with some, I guess you could call it deathcore, but it was probably more of, how about we go with, you know me, I love genre tags, progressive gentcore. Progressive deathcore. I don't know. Gent was actually a mistake. That slipped out. I didn't mean that. But anyway, it's The Contortionist, Exoplanet, on Good Fight Music. So this is another reissue that came out in, I think, 2015, if I'm not mistaken. And I pre-ordered that again because that was a CD that I really liked when I first heard it. So they were kind of going through this. It wasn't quite deathcore. It kind of had this canoodling between the Buried and Me guitar work. I guess it kind of gets lumped in with progressive, and I know progressive folks get mad when you start lumping anything core in it, but I'm really just talking to myself here, so you know, get mad if you'd like. But this had a couple of particular banging songs. Oscillator was one of them, and then I think the other one was Flourish. Where they had the I'll call them deathcore parts, but they weren't quite that. There's no pig squeals or anything like that. Just a little bit heavier than hardcore. But I think you kind of know what I'm talking about. It's not quite genty, not quite deathcore, not quite progressive, but little bits and pieces of possibly all of those. And you know, I actually got to see, it really actually kind of rounds this out quite nicely, which wasn't even my intent. So The Contortionist again is another band that I've only dabbled with since this initial release. I liked Language. I thought it was real good, but they went, as a lot of bands like them do, they really go towards the progressive route. So you end up not listening, you know, there ends up not being a lot of the heavier parts that really kind of drew you in the first place. And sometimes you adapt to that and sometimes you don't. And with them, it wasn't even just them. It was just, you know, it was just kind of a flash in the pan music style for me at the time. I didn't really stick with it too much. I took bits and pieces of it and still continue to. But ultimately, I ended up seeing The Contortionist open for Tesseract. And that was a fantastic show. Rounding out that card was Sky Harbor, which was amazing. And I believe Era was on that show as well. But I can't quite remember if it ever was on that show or the Darkest Hour show. I honestly don't recall. But I ended up going to this show by myself. I had two tickets. You know, girlfriend, again, now wife, at the time just could not make it on somewhat short notice to get out of work. She was a nanny, so, you know, it wasn't just a regular job. You had to do a little bit of planning, of course, unless you were sick. That's a different story. But going to a concert with, you know, the man you're dating, isn't one of those things that you can just kind of call in and ask the family to pick up for you on the last minute. And I didn't have any friends that really cared for the music or were available at the time. So I think I've said this maybe either here in another podcast or possibly on one of my Instagram videos, that I just kind of met someone on Reddit and posted out there. It's like, hey, anybody interested in a free ticket for the show? I met them outside the venue in Boston and gave them the ticket and sent them on their way. Never saw them or heard from them again. So I hope they enjoyed the show as much as I did. But yeah, that was fantastic. I actually thought that Sky Harbor was really, really good. You know, some crossover there. So that the first singer for Tesseract, who became the, you know, came back, and I guess you'd call him the third singer for Tesseract, also sang in early Sky Harbor. So there's probably some really good, friendliness amongst all of those musicians. But the newer singer from Sky Harbor, Was fantastic as well. So they put on a great show. But I honestly thought, as great as Tesseract was, and they were the ones that got me there, I thought the Contortionist might have put on the show of the night there. I was really, really surprised, because even those songs that, on CD didn't translate to me as being particularly heavy or whatnot, live, they had just a completely different vibe. And I mean, they tore that place apart. When they went off, they went off. That place was, I thought the vocalist put on a great show. It was really, really just a fun show. And again, I think the Contortionist took the cake there. So anyway, I think I actually went on a little bit longer than I anticipated. For some reason, I thought that this might be out in, 7 to 10 minutes. But I guess I have a tendency to ramble once I get on a topic. So anyway, I'd be curious to hear, some feedback. You posted in notes. Have you ever checked your median value? And do you have any of those records that are really high up there? Any of them that surprise you? And any that you'd look at and say, you know what, that might be something that would be in better hands of another collector, and I could turn that into 5 or 6 new records that have more value to me. Hope you all enjoy your week. I know I'm not going to immensely, but I think I got to get through this holiday season as it is and try to make as much money as I can and get the hell out. I hope you all take care of yourselves and those around you.